This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In an article in the New York Times Magazine and in a new book, Kwame Anthony Appiah argues for a philosophy he calls cosmopolitanism. It's an idea that promotes individuals over nations, tribes, or peoples. And along the way, he challenges the critics of globalism who argue for international laws to preserve cultures and resist what they call cultural imperialism and promote ideals of cultural purity and authenticity. While Appiah concedes that globalism can produce homogeneity, the universal availability of, for example, Coca-Cola, American TV, or Guinness Stout, intercultural contamination stimulates change, he says. And he then adds, societies without change aren't authentic, they're just dead. In a moment, Anthony Appiah joins us to describe what a cosmopolitan world might look like. Later in the program, Russians ask questions about a British spy rock, and we want answers, as in, what's a spy rock? We'll also talk with a Canadian usually resident in this country who's running for parliament in Ontario. But first, cosmopolitanism, and we hope to hear from you. What are the rules in your multicultural world? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. And joining us now from NPR's Bureau in New York City is Kwame Anthony Appiah, professor of philosophy at Princeton. His new book is titled Cosmopolitanism, Ethics in a World of Strangers. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
It's very nice to be with you.
And I've left out a couple of key ideas about cosmopolitanism, which you stress, and those would be tolerance and humility.
Yes. I think the key thing, if you're going to be open to the world, is that you approach the world in the spirit of assuming you can learn from the world. Conversation, which is one of my metaphors in the book, conversation is only worth doing if you're listening as well as talking. So I think it does require a kind of cultural and intellectual humility. And tolerance, absolutely, though again, tolerance has to have its limits. We can't tolerate people who are deeply inhumane, who are cruel. We obviously can't tolerate genocide and so on. But I think cosmopolitans are going to be much more broadly tolerant than anti-cosmopolitan or uncosmopolitan people.
Mm-hmm. Another word you use, a word that most people would take as a pejorative, but you use it as a positive, contamination.
Yes. Well, it's of course meant as a little bit of a provocation, but
no.
I do think, this is actually a word with a very interesting history in this context, because it was used, first of all, a long time ago in the second century before the Common Era, to refer to the style of literary work that Terence, the Roman dramatist and comedian, wrote. Comedy writer. Mm-hmm. And he wrote in Latin, but he borrowed plots and ideas from Greek originals. And some people thought that was bad, and so they tried to stigmatize it by calling it contamination. And being a smart fellow, Terence said, no, it's contamination, and contamination isn't bad, it's good. It's good to borrow and build on the achievements of other civilizations. It's good to borrow ideas from other places.
The other source you cite is Picasso, who said good artists borrow, great artists steal.
Right. They steal, and they steal from everywhere. That's the key thing. We famously, some of the sort of ideas in Cubism came from Picasso's exposure to African sculpture. How did he get to see the African sculpture? In the house of an American, namely Gertrude Stein. Where? In Paris. He was a Spaniard. Perfect mixture, Spanish, African, Vili, in fact, I think is where some of the sculptures came from, American, French, and that's what created Picasso.
Another example of contamination you cite is what we now think of as a traditional African garb, the kente cloth.
Absolutely. I grew up in the home of kente. Kente was in of the sort that is now known all around the United States and indeed around the world. Kente was first woven in a village called Bonwiri, just outside Kumasi, which is my hometown, a couple hundred years ago, made of silk. There was no silk in that part of the world. Where did the silk come from? Trade. It was brought in by Europeans, grown in Asia. The designs were Asante, but probably produced in part in reaction to exposure to designs from other parts of that region, and probably after looking at cloth from Europe as well, and possibly some from Asia. It became very much identified with Ghana, not just with Asante, which is a part of Ghana, but with the whole country, because Nkrumah, the president, used to wear it on official occasions. It's worn by the king of Ashanti. It's also worn in strips around the necks of graduating students at Howard University.
It's presumably worn on ceremonial occasions in Ghana. But people point out that most of the time, a lot of people would more likely be dressed in baseball caps and T-shirts.
Yes, yes. I mean, one reason why it's worn on ceremonial occasions is rather similar to the reason why most people don't wear DJs all the time. It's expensive. To wear 12 yards of silk wrapped around you in a country where the average person earns under $1,000 a year and where that probably costs you $500, that's very expensive. But it's also because it was traditionally regarded as a ceremonial thing, and there are particular patterns of kente, which in Asante you can't wear unless you're a member of the royal Oyoko clan. But of course, those rules don't stop anybody in the United States. If somebody wants to wear the finest kente woven in Bonwiri for the royals, and she can afford it, she can do it. Hmm. But so most of the people aren't wearing it most of the time. They're wearing jeans, T-shirts. They're wearing shirts and shoes from Korea, China, India, and Europe. And why? Well, one reason is they're cheap. We can afford them. Many of them come in secondhand, of course. But they're affordable. And the other is they keep you covered. I mean, they're good clothing. And people who wear them don't, I think, mostly think of them as coming from anywhere in particular. They just think of them as clothing that it's cheap and convenient to wear.
I remember being in the Solomon Islands a few years ago and just marveling at the number of Yankee baseball caps.
Yes. And I don't know if you tried this, but often, with those sort of symbols, and I think this is a very important point about contamination, you'll ask someone, okay, so do you know what that thing means?
Yeah.
And some of them will, but some of them won't. And some of them will have a strange, mistaken idea of what it means. Because when these sorts of cultural objects travel, they don't come with an interpreter. They don't come with someone who tells you what they mean. And so people can reinterpret things. I suppose people think of Coca-Cola as a relatively informal drink in the United States, but where I grew up, it's something you can drink and offer someone on a respectable occasion at a funeral, say, as a sign of respect. So these objects travel all over the place, but they don't necessarily travel with the meanings that they have where they come from. I just mentioned with the kente, most people in my hometown would recognize the pattern of a royal kente, and so would assume if they saw someone wearing it that they were from that that clan. Obviously, if somebody wears that kente in Washington, D.C., first of all, there's no reason to suppose they are a member of the clan, and second, most people won't know.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. We're talking with Anthony Appiah, author most recently of Cosmopolitanism. He's also a professor of philosophy at Princeton University. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us, or send us an email, talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Ken. And Ken is calling from Concord in California.
Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for letting me on the program.
Sure.
One of the things I've noticed, and what your take is on one cultural appropriation, especially American Indian appropriation, misusing symbols that we use in sacred ceremonies. I'm from South Dakota. And also, what about cultures, for instance, tribal cultures in this country that the dominant culture has categorically tried to destroy in many different ways? And one of the strengths of our culture is to preserve our culture and traditions and give us a sense of identity and place. What's your take on that?
Well, no sane person's going to be against identity in the modern world. No sane person is going to think that we should all have only a human identity and nothing else. Identities of that sort, local ethnic identities, regional identities, family identities, all of these matter deeply to human beings. And so, as you can imagine, I'm not against them. I have them myself, and I value the ones that I have. What I was arguing against was a kind of view which aims to come to people from the outside and tell them how to be authentic, come a view that says, "Oh, you can't do that. You're an Indian. Indians don't do that.
Indians don't build casinos.
Indians don't build casinos." It seems to me. It's roughly speaking, it's up to Indians to decide what Indians do, and if Indians want to do something different from what they used to do, that's their business, as far as I'm concerned. So that's the main point. As far as appropriation is concerned, I guess I may disagree with you a little bit about this. I think that when we borrow symbols from other places, we obviously have to be careful to be respectful. We saw this in this city of New York, where I'm sitting right now, some years ago, when a famous artist did a representation of a crucifix, a cross, which was embedded in human urine. I mean, it was stored in human urine. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, if you're a religious person, if you're a Christian of any sort, you're likely to be at least potentially offended by that. The guy who did it actually meant it as a sacramental gesture. He was thinking of human body products as somehow sacramental. But of course, there was no reason why the average Christian viewer should have known that. In those sort of contexts, you risk offending people, and courtesy is a fine principle of cross-cultural interaction. So when people borrow things from other people, I think they should do so respectfully. But we were just talking just now about kente cloth. I mean, I don't think people in Asante can stop people in New York wearing kente cloth that in Asante is only worn by royals. Maybe we'd rather they didn't. That depends on your attitude to royalty. But
right.
Being a Republican myself, I'm with a small R, I'm not sure that I worry too much about that. But plenty of people in the Santee would think it wrong to wear something that was not, as it were, appropriate to who you were. But I think that, you know, we don't have the right. People take the cloth, they value it. I think we should be pleased that they've borrowed from us and valued what they've borrowed.
Ken, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking with Anthony Appiah about his new book, Cosmopolitanism, Ethics in a World of Strangers. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255 or talk@npr.org. Back after the break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our subject today is cosmopolitanism, and our guest is philosopher Anthony Appiah. He's got a new book out by that name. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, our email address, talk@npr.org. What do we have in common across cultures? And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Zalia. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Zalia, yes.
In Tucson, Arizona. Go ahead.
Yep. Thank you very much for having me. I just wanted to comment that we're talking about globalization and cosmopolitanism as if it's an equal and fair exchange of ideas and cultures around the globe, but I really don't see that in a lot of ways. And I see that the globalization movement is a lot of times driven by corporatism and the drive for profit. And for instance, you don't see the world pushing on America or American culture, incorporating a lot of the world's ideas of relaxation. But, for instance, here along the border, if you go to Mexico, you see a lot of American corporations kind of globalizing outward, but you don't see a lot of Mexican corporations globalizing inward. So I just wanted to say that I think it's framed in a way that makes the cosmopolitan look very democratic, but I don't think that that's fundamentally what's driving globalization, and I'll take the response off the air. Thanks
for the call.
Well, I don't. Globalization really isn't my word, and I think the word globalization is used now to mean so many different things that it's not always sort of helpful when you're trying to think about these things to use it.
You do use it a lot.
I use it to describe a particular phenomenon. The phenomena that I think are most important here are relevant to the very idea of cosmopolitanism, because the idea of cosmopolitanism, of course, given the etymology, it's just from a Greek phrase meaning citizen of the world. The idea of cosmopolitanism requires us to think of ourselves as citizens of a single human community. In order to do that, there are two essential preconditions, it seems to me, for that to make sense. One is that we should actually be able to affect one another. the first cosmopolitans in the 4th and 5th century BC, they couldn't affect people everywhere on the globe, so they didn't meet that condition. And the second thing is that we should know about other people. And the 5th century and 4th century cosmopolitans didn't know about most people in the world. They didn't know what was going on in most of the human community. The features of globalization that I think are important are, for my purposes, are we can affect other people. We do affect people all the time. We buy their stuff. We sell them stuff. Our armies are in their countries and so on. And we can know about them, not just through radio and television, but obviously increasingly through the World Wide Web. That's the kind of globalization I'm interested in. The phenomenon of the economic globalization, which is, I think, something that's happened over a much longer timescale, actually, well, it has its bad side. I'm not going to defend everything that's ever been done by a corporation. And I do think that one of the, and I say in the book, that one of the things that I do share with people who want to preserve culture is a concern to make sure that the people who want to hold on to things, who want to hold on to valuable traditions of their own, have the resources to do so. But as I said in response to Ken, I think it's important that it's their decision what they hold on to. It's not up to us to tell people how to be authentically a Mexican or authentically Zuni or authentically anything else. So, yes, there are dangers with the corporations. Kind of corporatization can do damage internationally, can do damage at home. You don't have to be an enthusiast for the market in every context to think that, nevertheless, a global market in ideas, the global exchange of cultural objects mediated by money, is a good thing. I wish that there was more money in say, Africa, because then people in Africa would be better placed not only to participate on equal terms politically, but also on equal terms culturally. We'd be seeing more of the cultural product of Africa than we do if there were stronger industries in Africa. Mm-hmm. And if African governments were in a position to defend their cultural products in the way that the United States very successfully tries to defend its cultural products in the world market.
Let's talk now with Steve. Steve calling from Portland, Oregon.
Hi. I was really fascinated by your comment about brand images and how meaning is assigned or not assigned, or people will take the wrong meaning from wearing a Yankee baseball cap. And I'd like you to comment, if you would, on brand imaging and brand identities and the cultural restrictions, say, in the Muslim world, where, as I understand it, the portrayal of humans and others in art would run against, you know, sort of the cultural contamination. Mm-hmm. And I'll take my response, take your response off.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Steve, thank you.
There's a lot in the book about Islam, not because I'm a Muslim, I'm not, but because I think that figuring out how to relate in a cosmopolitan way to the many Islamic societies of the world is one of the great challenges we face today. The Muslim countries which are predominantly Muslim, stretch, of course, from Morocco to Indonesia, and the largest Muslim country in the world is Indonesia, which isn't in the Arab world at all, as people often forget. It is true that some traditions in Islam were hostile to the representation of the human form, or indeed of animals, but it's also true that some of the finest representations of humans, for example, in Persian miniatures, were produced in Muslim societies. So we shouldn't assume Islam, like Christianity, is complex and internally very diverse. That means that in the places where the representation of humans is thought to be religiously forbidden or idolatrous or something, they won't take kindly to borrowing of those representations. And, you know, roughly speaking, my view is that's up to them if they don't want to. I think they lose out by it. But in order to figure out whether what they lose out by it is matters, they're going to have to figure out what they think about this fundamental religious question of how to whether you may and may not represent people. And it doesn't seem to me that it's my job as an outsider to tell them what to do about it, or our job as outsiders to force upon them a different cultural world from the one that they're going to produce democratically by themselves. If you go to I just spent some time recently in in the Middle East. I was in Oman and a little bit in Dubai. You wouldn't know what our caller just said. You wouldn't know what Steve just said from being in those places, because they're full of representations mm-hmm. of human beings.
Well, you said it's not our job to tell them what to do about their representations in their art. Is it our job to tell them about what they should do about women's rights?
I think that that should be the topic of a global conversation. And first of all, women are half the population, mm-hmm. roughly speaking, of the species. And when people say, well, one question you might ask in response to that sort of issue is, well, who's the they? Half of them are women. Do they think that they should have the place in public life that the men who speak for the society say they should? Not all of them. Not all the men think that that's right. It's not as if there's a single view about these things, again, within Islam or within particular Muslim countries. I do think that because there is a global conversation now about gender, it's perfectly appropriate for us to have through organizations like the UN Women's conferences, to have global conversations about the status of women, and when countries sign up, as they often do, to treaties, to point out that if you have a treaty obligation, then it's part of the job of the international community to make sure you live up to it. In those conversations, those global conversations, we will hear things about the way women are treated and behave in the West. That's what I mean by conversation. If you're going to talk, you have to listen. And some of what they say about how women are treated in the West, we may or may not agree with, but it might change our view about how we see the way they treat women in the various places over there. So I think it's cosmopolitanism for me has two strands. One is that you have to take seriously the idea that we're collectively responsible, all of us, for the fate of all of us. But the other is respect for the choices people make to be different from one another. But the baseline of the first commandment, which is that everybody matters, means that if a society other than our own is treating people in a way that they ought not to be treated, yes, I think we have the right to talk about it, just as they have the right to tell us that we're treating people in ways we shouldn't in Guantanamo Bay, that we're treating people in ways we shouldn't, the Europeans would tell us, we're treating people in the ways we shouldn't in our prisons, that our prison system falls below international standards of human rights and so on. These are perfectly legitimate topics of conversation across cultures, I think.
Let's talk now with Adam. Adam is with us from Kalamazoo.
Hi, I was wondering how you account for these ethical differences and what kind of methodology you see in coming to these conclusions of a universal truth or, human rights, as you've mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think here it's very important to distinguish between two different questions. One is how I, or maybe philosophers in my tradition, decide these things. I could give you a course on that. It's not easy to give a short answer to. But whatever my answer is to that question, in the end, how we're going to develop human rights discourse across the species isn't going to depend on the answer to that question. It's going to depend upon all of us conversing with one another about what things we take to be fundamental to human dignity and how we're going to make sure that everybody gets access to them. In those conversations, it's not going to be helpful for me to appeal to complicated metaphysical ideas from the Western tradition or from any tradition. It's going to be helpful rather just to engage with people, to exchange ideas. And one of the striking things that's happened is, as Michael Ignatieff once said in a nice formulation, human rights has gone global by going local. People all over the planet have used human rights treaties and language to fight fights locally. And that's the way in which human rights, I think, is going to get everywhere. It's going to be because women in Bangladesh, in particular communities, use the language of human rights to ask why they lose their property rights when their husbands die and so on.
I thought a good example you gave in the book was the change in China that ended within a generation, the centuries-old practice of foot binding.
Yes. That's a very interesting example. I don't understand it well enough yet. And one of the things that I'm trying to work on actually for the next project is to figure out what really went on in that case. So here is a practice that went on for 1,000 years or so in China of binding women's feet into sort of very very painful way. And until the turn of the last century, this was thought to be very beautiful, and women of good family were pretty much unmarriageable unless this had been done to them when they were young. And then in the course of a generation, about 20 years or so, there was a big shift. And at the end of that shift, many young women who had their feet bound in order that they should be beautiful were unmarriageable. After 1,000 years, over about a generation, the Chinese gave it up. They gave it up for lots of reasons, but one of them was the result of a sense that they were they were failing to live up to a kind of universal human standard. They had the idea that they looked kind of backward and primitive to other people, and they didn't want to look backward and primitive to other people, and so they argued through these anti-foot-binding societies that formed all over China to persuade families to stop, and as I say, in the course of a generation, it stopped. There's a similar thing that happened, which I don't talk about in the book, but mm-hmm. It's a very interesting story, with abolition. As we all know, in the 17th century in this country and into the early 18th century, while there were abolitionists and while people like Quakers were deciding that they couldn't own slaves, by and large, people took slavery rather for granted. At a certain point, around about 1800 or so, large numbers of people in the Western world, which had had forms of slavery basically forever, came round to a different view, according to which it was wicked, uncivilized, old-fashioned, and wrong to have and use slaves. How did that happen? I mean, again, you know, this is a story that's been told, but I still think it's we don't understand it well enough. We don't understand how these forms of moral change occur. But one thing we can say about them is that they happened as the result of a conversation that was not national. It wasn't that there was one conversation in England and one in France and one in the United States.
I have to say that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. Let's talk with Jennifer, and Jennifer is calling us from Kumasi in Ghana.
Hello.
Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Yes, I'm calling from Professor Appiah's hometown.
Great.
Would first like to say I really appreciated his article in the New York Times.
I have a question
about education. Professor, how do you respond to the fact that the education system in West Africa is a result of colonialism and can sometimes be ineffectual in the context of the culture and the economic realities of the country? Do you think it's properly preparing students for the economic realities that they will face upon graduation?
We're trying hard, obviously, to make our modern education system relevant to our modern circumstances, and that applies to primary, secondary, and tertiary education. And I think there are obviously features of the way the system developed. The modern education system was essentially the result of a mixture of colonial policy and, I should say, the creation of schools by missionaries from many different religious denominations, Christian denominations, and in the north, Muslim education. It does have this history. But I do think that, increasingly we've tried to shift the education system to reflect the realities more. They made a change about a decade ago, which increased the frequency with which ordinary people got to spend some of their time in their school learning how the vast majority of Ghanaians make their living, which is by farming, and so on. But I should say that I also think it is important for us to be educating people who are first-rate, knowledgeable people in the global systems of knowledge, in physics, in computer science, in economics, and so on, because we are not going to make progress. Nobody in the world now can make progress without being engaged with the world system. And one of the things that I think is great about Ghana is that, by and large, most Ghanaians have been enormously open to the world. In my book, I talk about a family that grew up on the street that I grew up on, and they now live in four different. They live in Japan, Spain, London, New York. All these brothers, and most of them didn't finish high school. But they were prepared for the world and open to the world, and they've got jobs in these places. But they couldn't have done that if they hadn't learned how to speak European languages and so on.
I'm just running out of time here. Jennifer, thanks very much. We appreciate the call.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Anthony Appiah mentioned Michael Ignatieff. By chance, we're talking to him when we come back after the break. We'll also be running for Parliament in Canada. We're going to talk about the difference between Canadian and American politics. And we'll also have more about cosmopolitanism. This is NPR News. We're talking about cosmopolitanism with Kwame Anthony Appiah. His new book is of that name. Ethics in a World of Strangers is the title. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Lauren. Lauren's calling from Cheyenne, Eugene, Oregon.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
And I had a question I want to ask just about maybe a particular culture and... In fact, it's and that would be the French are famous for trying to exclude American phrases, Americanisms, slang, and so on from their culture, their literature.
To protect the purity of the language, yes.
Yeah, what effect do you think this has had? This attempt to avoid cultural contamination has had effect on the French culture, whether it's literature or whether it's had a reverse effect or.
I don't know whether it's had a reverse effect, but I can tell you that it hasn't worked, as everybody who spent any time in France will tell you. After all, you couldn't have a weekend without English, and that would mean most of the weekly vacations of the French would have to go. You can't move earth around in Paris without un bulldozer. So I'm afraid that try as they might, they're ignoring the fundamental thrust of human cultural history when they try to do that. One of the reasons why English has been so successful is that it doesn't have an Académie Anglaise busy trying to keep it pure and clean. English is a wonderful language in part because it's full of Germanic and Latinate and South Pacific and African words. It's full of words like taboo, which comes from the South Pacific. So they tried, they failed, they were bound to fail in my view, because that's not how people are. If people see a good idea somewhere else, they borrow it.
Lauren, thanks very much.
Yeah, well, thanks. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And just a couple of minutes left with you, Anthony Appiah, and I wanted to ask you briefly about the groups of people you call anti-cosmopolitanists, and those would be universalists, many, though not all, of religious beliefs.
Yes. I mean, if I'm worried about, as it were, one group of enemies of cosmopolitanism, it is people who are like cosmopolitans universalists, that is, they think that the whole human community matters, and they're preoccupied and concerned about the whole human community. But they don't share the second strand of cosmopolitanism, which is this respect for difference, this tolerance and recognition of our own intellectual moral fallibility, a willingness to listen. And many Christians are cosmopolitan. Cosmopolitanism entered Christianity very early on. St. Paul said, in me there is neither Jew nor Greek, and that's a cosmopolitan sentiment. But many modern Christians and many modern Muslims and many modern Hindus, for example, are deeply anti-cosmopolitan. They care about the whole world, but they want the world to be reshaped in their own image. And it's that willingness to live alongside and in a world with people who are different from you that I think distinguishes cosmopolitanism from other forms of more homogenizing universality, and that makes it, for me, a more hopeful way of thinking about how we can live together as fellow citizens of the planet than the views of the fundamentalists who think the only way to do that is to convert everybody to their picture.
Anthony Appiah's new book is Cosmopolitanism, Ethics in a World of Strangers. Thanks very much for joining us today.
It was a great pleasure, and say hi to Michael Ignatieff.
Oh, very briefly, very shortly. Anthony Appiah joined us from our bureau in New York City. The aforementioned Michael Ignatieff may seem an unlikely candidate for political office. The noted historian and novelist is more accustomed to roaming the ivy-covered walls of academe than glad-handing constituents for votes, but that's what the former Harvard professor has been doing these past few weeks. He's running as a Liberal Party candidate in today's federal election in Canada. Having lived the past 30 years here in the States, many of his readers, students, and perhaps even some of his own constituents may not have known that the prolific writer is indeed a Canadian citizen. Michael Ignatieff joins us now on the phone from the city of Etobicoke, a western suburb of Toronto. And Anthony Appiah says hi.
Hi, Anthony. It was lovely to hear his sober, lucid voice of reason up here in Canada.
Well, in a recent interview, you said you knew at the age of 21 that you wanted to run for public office. Somehow you seem to have gotten sidetracked over the past 30 years.
I know. I don't know what happened exactly, but I worked for one of our great Canadian leaders, Prime Minister Trudeau, in the 60s, and then went and became an academic, a writer, and a journalist. But the bug was always there, and this is my country. This is where the plumb line of my politics has always been, and I felt it was time, having taught a lot of public service and public policy to my Harvard students, it was time to come back and do a little bit of my own.
Having observed politics in this country and obviously following politics in your own native country, how are they different?
They really couldn't be more different. Canadians and Americans look alike and sound alike and talk alike, and Americans are our best friends and best neighbors, but, you know, we have a universal health care system. We don't have capital punishment anywhere. Women's rights to choose are secure. Gay marriage is an acquired fact in our political landscape. The plumb line of our politics is considerably to the left of most American public policy, and I'm much more comfortable in that zone of public policy than I am in the rest of the spectrum.
I was also talking about process. I would think, for example, it would cost a great deal less to run to be a member of Parliament than it would to be run as a representative in Congress.
Absolutely. I think it'd be impossible for me to run in the United States. Much as I love the States, a parliamentary seat in Canada, I think we will spend in the order of $100,000 Canadian, absolute tops, to run in for the equivalent of Congress. And so you can see how different it is.
At those prices, it doesn't sound as if you're crowding the airwaves with a lot of advertisements.
No, you certainly aren't. We do politics the old hard way. It's ground game all the way. I canvass door to door, shake hands at subways, do little tea parties with constituents. It's retail politics at the most basic, and I've actually, weirdly, really, really enjoyed it.
I wonder, at least on the national level in this election in Canada, relations with the United States and anti-Americanism have been an issue. The charges, the Liberal Party has been charging the conservative leader is too much like President Bush and all of that. I wonder, as somebody who's lived in the States for 30 years, of course, you're running for as a Liberal representative, but are you being accused of being, an American carpetbagger?
There's a bit of that going on. I have to... NPR is famously accurate. I haven't lived in the States for 30 years. I've actually lived in the States for 5.
Ah.
But there are accusations that I'm a little too close to the Americans, and I'm unrepentantly pro-American. I love American institutions and American liberty, and I think there has been quite a lot of anti-Americanism in the campaign, but I'm hoping that Americans understand that we do politics just like you do up there, down in the States. That is, there's quite a lot of exaggeration, and then after the campaign is over, normal service resumes. I mean, Canadians understand and are closer to Americans than any other people on earth.
And let me ask you also a question about political passion. Obviously, the number of voters, with the exception of the last election here in the States, general election, has declined over the past several decades. Canadians, are they excited about politics? Do they come out and vote in large numbers?
Well, you know, I had All I can say is in the little world of Etobicoke Lakeshore where I'm running, we had 800 people out to a candidates meeting in a public school, 400 at another meeting. Our voter turnout will be in, I hope, north of 60-65% today. I think your voter turnouts are lower.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a good deal of public engagement. People think this is an important election. And every time a candidate like me or in any party gets up, you're really playing to defend and enhance public confidence in the political system itself. And so, you know, we're not just running for our parties. We're running so that people believe in the democratic process itself. And being part of it has been pretty unforgettable, actually.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you so much, sir.
Okay. Michael Ignatieff, a historian, novelist, and former Harvard professor, currently a political candidate running for the Liberal Party in today's federal election in Canada, in just a suburb of Toronto.